Today's reading is taken from Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 to 13, which can be found on page 813 of the Church Pew Bibles. Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 to 13. When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will, be clean." And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them." When he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment.
Shana, thanks very much for reading. Let me add my welcome as well and ask you to keep that passage in Matthew 8 open in front of you. And there should be an outline on the back of the handout you got on the way in, which might help you. In 2013, Paul Kalanithi was just about to finish his training as a neurosurgeon, age 36, when he was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. Over Christmas, I got hold of this book that he wrote in the 2 years before he died, When Breath Becomes Air. It became a worldwide bestseller. It's his memoir about his battle with cancer and his reflections on life. And he died while he was writing it. Abraham Verghese, who writes the foreword, recalls his meeting with Paul to discuss his initial ideas for the book. And he describes his vivid recollection of the scene. This is what he says: "I remember thinking, 'You must remember this, because what was falling on my retina was precious. And because, in the context of Paul's diagnosis, I became aware not just of his mortality, but my own.'" I wonder when you last had that feeling yourself. I'm sure we'll have all had it at some point, when the sickness or the death of someone close to us made us very suddenly aware of our own mortality. I'm really sorry if that is something you've been dealing with recently. If that's you, I really hope what we're going to be looking at today in Matthew's gospel is going to be just what your soul needs. If you haven't, well, just stop and look around for a moment and you'll see there are plenty of reminders around us every day that death's shadow looms over our lives. You only need to go around the corner and look at the very large hospital. And modern medicine is a wonderful thing. It's great that many of those who go in there will come out again healed. But, of course, every single one that does will eventually be back in there, this time for good. And one day that will be me, and that'll be you. Well, Happy New Year to you too, Ed, you might think. We do try our best, don't we, to ignore death's shadow and pretend that it's not there. I had a a really sad story recently. It's from a Christian guy who was on a cancer ward, who overheard a conversation the young man, Gary, in the bed next to his, had with his father, who'd come to visit him. So Dad comes in and says, "How are you doing?" Gary says, "Dad, they tell me I've got 5 weeks to live." Father says, "You know, I'm sorry I'm late. It's just ever so hard to find a parking space." Gary says, "Dad, I've got 5 weeks to live." Dad says, "You know, next time I think I'll come by bus." A guy overhearing this said he was so angry with the father, he nearly got out of his bed and shook him. But then he realized Gary's dad is just where most of us are in our thinking about death, in denial. See, the secular world, it just has absolutely nothing to say in that situation. No hope to give. And that is why I love this new section of Matthew's gospel so much that we're starting today, because over the course of these next two chapters, Matthew confronts us with story after story of sickness and death, and he wants you and me to consider our own mortality as we read about these people, and to see that there is one hope only in the face of the death that will come to us all. And it is such a glorious hope. Back in chapter 4, we saw Matthew announce that Jesus had come to fulfill this promise from the book of Isaiah. It was our theme verse earlier. "The people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light, and for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them a light has dawned." Well, what we see happen in chapters 8 and 9 is Jesus driving back the darkness of the shadow of death everywhere he goes. Half of Jesus' miracles in Matthew's gospel occur in these two chapters. So imagine this for a moment. Imagine footage of a tornado sweeping through a town. Or maybe one of those old clips of a fake town in the Nevada desert being devastated by a nuclear bomb blast. Picture that. And then imagine that played in reverse. Now, reading these chapters is a bit like watching those scenes played in reverse. Instead of bringing destruction, Jesus sweeps through Galilee like a whirlwind of restoration. He's like this explosion of life. It's Matthew's next window for us into the kingdom that Jesus said that he would bring. And just after that quote from Isaiah in chapter 4, he told us this, that Jesus went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. And in other words, Jesus proclaimed his kingdom by teaching about it and by demonstrating it. And if you were with us before Christmas, we saw Jesus teaching us about the kingdom in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, now we see the demonstration. 2,000 years ago, Jesus gave the world a foretaste of life in his kingdom. A life no longer lived under death's dark shadows, where sickness and disease and mourning will all be things of the past. Jesus' teaching itself has already been enough to persuade people of his unique authority. And remember how right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew records this, chapter 7, verse 28, that the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. Well, chapter 8 begins with the stories of two people who believed in Jesus' authority. Notice they both address him as Lord. And he both instantly saw that belief vindicated. And we're going to trace through three things these episodes highlight about Jesus as he confronts the shadow of death. And the first is his unparalleled authority. Leprosy was perhaps the most dreaded disease of the day. It was incurable and highly contagious. And people treated lepers effectively like the walking dead. They were cast out and left to die. Which makes the confidence this leper shows in Jesus utterly astonishing. Verse 2. Behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. That is an extraordinary thing to say. A few months ago now, I went to see a gastroenterologist at UCLH about a stomach issue. I've had it for about 10 years, so I didn't have much hope that he'd be able to help. But he's a leading expert, so I thought, well, while I'm living around the corner, I might as well give it a shot, see if he might be able to relieve the symptoms a bit. You know, it never once crossed my mind to go in and say to him, Dr. Emmanuel, if you're willing, you can heal me. But this leper, well, he doesn't just come as a last resort and say to Jesus, look, Jesus, I know this is a long shot, but do you think you might be able to do something about this? And he doesn't say, Jesus, if you're able, please help me just a bit. But Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. I mean, just imagine this in history. Like, what kind of things must Jesus have been doing in first century Israel for even this isolated leper to have heard enough reports of Jesus to put this kind of confidence in his authority? And it's no wishful thinking. Verse 3, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I will be clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. So here's the first sign of hope for us as we dwell in the shadow of death. In fact, it's an even more significant sign than it might first appear. Verse 4 hints at that. As Jesus tells this former leper now to show himself to the priest. That's a bit odd. We might think show himself to a doctor would make sense. Why show himself to a priest? Well, see, for Israel, leprosy had a spiritual significance. It was symbolic of the condition that every single one of us is in because of our sin. We are unclean before God. We've rejected him. And so, spiritually speaking, we are the walking dead, separated from him. That's the whole reason death entered God's good creation in the first place. And so the cleansing of a leper, it's just a hint of something that we'll see much more clearly in a couple of weeks' time. That Jesus has the authority not just to deal with sickness and death, but even with the root of those things, with our sin itself. Well, the centurion's confidence is no less striking, is it? Verse 6, his servant's lying paralyzed, suffering terribly. He seems to be at death's door. And what he says is remarkable for any number of reasons. I mean, the fact that he comes to Jesus for help at all is pretty shocking. And from a Jewish perspective, you know, in many ways, the centurion would have been seen as just as much an outsider as the leper. Because he's a Gentile, and not just any Gentile, but a commanding officer of the hated occupying Roman army. But not only does he come, it's his reply to Jesus in verse 8 that is most astonishing. Verse 7, Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion replied, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. But only say the word, and my servant will be healed. Again, just consider for a moment what kind of reports of Jesus this centurion must have heard to say something like that? I mean, you might possibly write off the leper as being delirious because of his condition. I've known, sadly, some desperate people who've persuaded themselves that a kind of dodgy alternative treatment is going to magically solve their problems. But in this case, the centurion's not even the one suffering. He wasn't out of his mind in desperation. What would have persuaded him to come to someone who, by any measure, was of far lower social standing, from a foreign nation, and call him Lord, and say, I'm not worthy to have you as my guest, and trust with complete confidence that this man could heal his servant at a distance with just a word? Well, verse 9 explains what the centurion had become convinced of. See, he was a man who knew authority when he saw it. Verse 9, for I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Roman centurions were ultimately under the authority of the emperor, and so their soldiers obeyed them because they had received authority from above. Well, this centurion sees the same thing very clearly with Jesus. Jesus is obviously someone who has been given an authority far beyond his or any powerful man. This is a man with power. On the right of this picture, that's 45-year-old Brian Johnson. It made his millions in Silicon Valley. He now spends $2 million a year on treatments to try and stay young and to stave off death, including recently using blood transfusions from his 17-year-old son on the left. He claims it's slowed down his aging by 24%. Quite impressive if that's true. But he's still going to die one day. Suffering, sickness, death, they're things that are so hardwired into the nature of this world. I mean, who could possibly give us any real hope of a world without them? Only someone who has been given the full authority of the one who created the world. That's what the centurion sees. And someone with that authority, well, obviously isn't going to need to be in the same postcode to heal his servant, he reasons. Just say the word, he says. And again, he's proven quite right. Verse 13. And to the centurion, Jesus said, go, let it be done for you as you've believed. And the servant was healed at that very moment. Jesus' authority is the big thing these stories highlight. But, you know, I love how they also show his compassion. I think back to the leper again. Verse 2 poses something of a question. If you're willing, you can make me clean. But is he willing? Sometimes it's said that in view of all the suffering in the world, well, either God can't deal with suffering because he's not really there, or it must be that he just doesn't care. But in Jesus, we see God's coming into our darkness and showing that he cares. I am willing, he reassures us. Be clean. He is willing to save the outcast. He's willing to save the complete outsider. In fact, the centurion comes away with something far better than he came expecting. Verse 10. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Verse 10, it's a wonderful commendation of the centurion's remarkable faith. No one in Israel had found such faith. But at the same time, it's something of a slap in the face to the Israelites of Jesus' day. And many of them assumed that because of their spiritual heritage, they were assured of having a place at the same table as their forebears, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who'd been given the promises of God. But Jesus warned that many of them would be disappointed. Verse 12, left on the outside, still in darkness. Why? Well, because they wouldn't acknowledge his authority, the authority of their king, when he came. You know, in my job, I meet lots of people who think that they're okay with God because they have a faith in something, some notion of God. You know, many Israelites believed in God, and yet Jesus said they remained outside the kingdom. Rather, he says, it's this centurion who shows us exactly the kind of faith we need, the kind of faith that saves. Saving faith is a faith that Jesus has the full authority of God. It's a faith that calls him our Lord and that treats him like that. It's a faith that recognizes that we're not worthy. We don't deserve to be under the same roof as God, let alone sharing at his table, sharing the blessings of the kingdom of heaven. You know, I think verse 11 would have blown the centurion's mind, don't you? Because the implication is Jesus has a place for people like him. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table in the kingdom of heaven. Does that blow your mind? Can you picture your name on a place card at the heavenly banquet, seating you next to Abraham on one side and Isaac on the other and Jacob across the table from you? Can you imagine feasting together with them in a place where sickness and pain and the shadows of death are nothing but a distant memory? See, if you don't feel like you belong there in God's kingdom, well, then the great news is that you are exactly the kind of person Jesus came for. Come to him as your Lord. Trust that he alone has the authority to save you from death. And Jesus promises there will be a place for you there. There will be a place for you. If you're trusting that already here today, I hope seeing these foretastes of the kingdom of heaven in these next couple of chapters, I hope it will put a spring in your step at the start of this new year. I mean, what could be better than knowing Jesus' authority to make death history? But I hope it will embolden us as well. And, you know, I wonder if those examples of commands that the centurion uses in verse 9, go and come, I wonder whether they might be a deliberate hint at what will be one of the big commands that Jesus will give his disciples in Matthew's gospel. Because we're going to see this section end with Jesus, in his compassion to see more people brought out of the shadow of death, sending out his disciples with the words, "Go to the lost." Go, same word. And that itself is a foreshadowing of how the whole book will end. Jesus says this in the final verses of the book: "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations." If we've grasped that Jesus has all of God's authority, the authority to roll away the shadow of death, well, the command of our Lord to us is to go and to make him known. And what extraordinary confidence these chapters are going to give us as we do that, because who else can give this kind of hope? There's nothing like this in all the world. The world has nothing to say in the face of death. Gary's dad, he is where most people are, isn't he? Having no answer except denial. We have real hope. Hope of life forever. Hope of a place at God's table. Hope because the Lord of life came in history and showed us a glimpse of a world where death's shadow will be a thing of the past. Should we pray?